Good evening, everyone. I am Ambika Satkunanathan. I am the chairperson of the Neelam Thiruchelvam Trust. And on behalf of the Board of Trustees, I would like to welcome you to the 18th Neelam Thiruchelvam Memorial Lecture. For those of you who may not know about the Neelam Thiruchelvam Trust, we are the only Sri Lankan grant-making organization supporting work, particularly work done by community organizations on human rights, good governance, and peace building. The trust was established in 2001 by the late Siti Thiruchelvam, wife of Dr. Neelam Thiruchelvam, in memory of Dr. Thiruchelvam. The aim was to continue his legacy and to further his values in particular, values such as diversity, pluralism, and most importantly, resolution of conflict through negotiation and dialogue. The annual memorial lecture speaks very strongly to a particular aspect of Dr. Thiruchelvam's his personality, his nature, and that is the importance he gave to scholarship and to ideas, to research. So the aim was to invite scholars, people who are doing interesting work, to contribute to ongoing discourse on key issues. So the lecture might contribute to ongoing discourse, initiate discourse, or sometimes even challenge dominant narratives. So it is in this spirit that this year we have invited Professor A.L. Wiseman. It now gives me great pleasure to introduce to you the person who will be chairing this evening's proceedings, Dr. Harini Amarasuriya. Dr. Amarasuriya is a senior lecturer at the Department of Social Studies at the Open University of Sri Lanka. She completed her PhD in social anthropology from the University of Edinburgh, where her dissertation work explored the nexus between the state, development policy, and practice within the bureaucracy, specifically in relation to probation and childcare services in Sri Lanka. Her work has included research in the areas of education, conflict, gender, globalization, and development. Prior to joining the Open University, she worked as a child protection and psychosocial practitioner for several years. She currently serves as a board member of NEST, a local NGO working on psychosocial issues, the Center for Women's Research, and the Law and Society Trust. And she also served as a member of the Public Representations Committee on Constitutional Reform that was appointed in 2016. Dr. Amarasuriya, Professor Wiseman, where is Eyal? Oh, yes, if you'd like to come up to the podium.
Thank you, Ambika. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Professor Eyal Wiseman, who's the Professor of Spatial and Visual Cultures at Goldsmiths in University of London. He's also the Director of the Center for Research and Architecture. Professor Wiseman, as many of you know, is a pioneer in the field of forensic architecture, which is, from what I could understand of it, a newly emerging field which looks at how architecture meets international humanitarian law and can be a device for documenting conflict, human rights, and abuse. He has lectured and curated at many international conferences, and he's currently a visiting scholar at Princeton. Professor Wiseman has received many awards. He was a recipient of the James Sterling Memorial Lecture Prize in 2006-2007, and he's the co-recipient of the 2010 Prince Claus Prize for Architecture, among many other awards that he has won. He has also published widely, and his books include The Least of All Possible Evils, Humanitarian Violence from Aren to Gaza, Hollow Land, Israel's Architecture of Occupation, and A Civilian Occupation. I'm sure we are going to hear something very special this evening, something that is of very topical interest to us right now. So, Professor Wiseman, over to you.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you, Dr. Harini, Amir Surya. Thank you, Mirak. Thank you, Ambika. Thank you, Shehara De Silva and Mianti, for making my family and my trip here so pleasurable. And I'm absolutely honored and humbled to be here speaking to you today in the memory of Dr. Tiruchelvam. Memorial lectures are about honoring the life and work of a person in whose name they are given, but they are also an invitation to walk their path, or to try to walk their path, make contact, form connections, and think ahead. This invitation, it seems to me, is a desire to do both. And in conversation that we had, this what in the conversation that we had in preparation for this lecture, it seems to me that this is what we are trying to do. The life of Neelan Tiruchelvam, as I slowly explore it to be, through his acquaintances, through people that worked with him and friends, seemed to me to be about holding together different forms of thought practice, different fields and sensitivities on the one hand, national level politics, law, human rights, and civil society work, and on the other hand, a support for intellectual work, for the arts, and for culture. And that kind of moving across borders, disciplinary borders and fields, is something that I think we share very much, and somehow is perhaps the reason for this invitation. Importantly, it is also about bridging local politics with regional and universal aspirations. And indeed, that is the necessary reality of human rights work. To speak about local situation in the language of the universal, and also vice versa, to speak about universal aspiration in local languages. Understanding the complexities and seeking to speak to them need to recognize both context and nuance, the histories, the sense of fear, dignity, and hopes of communities in struggle, and some of the root causes of these struggles. The necessity and beauty of human rights work is that it must also transcend space and time, generate a sense of global conversation undertaken by civil society, develop the politics of those that are governed, not those that govern, not those of government, and form political solidarity and common struggle across and beyond borders. And it is really in this spirit that I come to speak here, as I am slowly learning the complex politics of this island, the history, the diversity of cultures and political groups that form the extremely dense and delicate balance that is sometimes holding, sometimes less so, in here. I was becoming keenly aware of the situation here when in January 2009, my attention was actually directed elsewhere. Obviously, as an Israeli born, still as an Israeli human rights activist, in January 2009, my attention was directed at the Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip. But at the time, while reading closely, while speaking on the phone, I could not go there at the time, by being in contact with people in Gaza, there was another conflict that I became keenly aware of. So always at the margin of the news that I was getting about Gaza, I understood a certain escalation of a conflict, a long conflict that was taking place here. Gaza was attacked, but there were two simultaneous conflicts. Were they related? Were they talking to each other? Each conflict is, of course, rooted in its own history. Its own contingencies led to its eruption and escalation, But did they share a language? And this is something I'd like to hear more from you than actually say and determine. Were they speaking and hearing each other in the language of bombs, of siege, of human shields, of irregular attack on civilians, in the language of the way they were justified? I'm not sure yet. You might be able to help me navigate. Could we have the slides, please? Well, there should be a slide here of the Gaza Strip, but let me continue. In the last days of 2008, Israel started bombing the densely populated Gaza Strip, an area landlocked between military siege line and the sea. In January 2009, the area was already invaded. Civilians are trapped in this area in outrageous and life-threatening density since 1948, since they were driven out of their homes in 1948 at the time of the formation of the State of Israel. 60 years, most of the population of Gaza are refugees. The population was keeping growing for those 60 years, but water supply was shrinking. Life in Gaza Strip was sustained merely by international aid. And the prognosis of those international aid is now that the Gaza Strip will become completely uninhabitable by the year 2020. My friends in Gaza tell me that it's already uninhabitable. We are being slowly killed, they're saying. Sorry, do you want to set up the... Should I go into your system?
And they'll connect it in a bit.
It won't still show now.
Hold on, Arthur.
Sorry, we'll get back to it in a second. Mira, come here. Do you know where's your system preference?
System preference, yeah.
Display. Great. Okay. Okay.
One last thing is to put it in focus.
Okay. I think we're getting there. The image should focus, get into focus soon. Most people in Gaza are refugees. Some of them were in the armed resistance. Some of the people in the armed resistance fired indistinguishably at Israeli civilian communities. Israel retaliated by force, by massive force, against the sources of fire, but killed 1,400 civilians while destroying almost 20% of buildings in the Gaza Strip. The Strip was a restricted zone for journalists, and the only or one of the ways to tell the story of that attack was actually left for the buildings. I said 20% of buildings were destroyed. And somehow it was the moment in the aftermath of the January 2009 attack and in the survey of the ruins of Gaza, each building telling a different story. This is a catalog of destruction produced at the time by the government of Gaza, which read every building. It read the ruins of buildings. It said a ruin that looks like that, choose any image here, has been created by either bomb or bulldozer, artillery, or controlled demolition by engineers, by military engineers. Each building told a story. Each building had a number that was either photographed by holding a piece of paper in front of the ruin or etched, tattooed onto the building itself. It is somehow there in that archive that I have learned, studied quite carefully in the aftermath of the war, that the contemporary archaeology that forensic architecture is has emerged. The idea of creating a human rights methodology or promoting it, of telling the histories of conflict by looking at the rubble that is left behind. And in that sense, forensic architecture could be understood as something like a pathology of the building. In the same way that a pathologist carefully looks at the texture and form of bones, reading the life of a person, perhaps identifying that person from a bone found in mass grave when DNA is not available, is a way to understand the archaeologist's work that forensic architecture is. Here on the right, Caroline Sturdy Coles is looking at the foundation of a building that is long gone on the surface of the earth, but its presence here in a concentration camp, in a former concentration camp in Yugoslavia, was telling a story of persecution and destruction. So forensic architects are for architecture what a pathologist is for medical practices, perhaps. But let's start somewhere else, because its origins, at least for me, started in another human rights report, one that I helped produce in 2002 about the effect of settlements in the West Bank. At the time, I was asked by a human rights organization operating in Israel-Palestine called B'Tselem, it's probably the biggest human rights group there, to write a report that would try to implicate architects and planners in human rights violations and perhaps also in war crimes. So usually we think about human rights violations and war crimes as something that is produced by military personnel or by politicians. And the question was, were architects also possibly complicit in them? And in order to do that, I've helped produce this map that you see here. What you see is the West Bank near the kind of the narrow area, area. This is the Tel Aviv metropolitan area here, the Jerusalem metropolitan area here. It's very, very small space. Everything in blue are areas where the Jewish settlements invade and cut apart Palestinian areas in this map drawn in brown. So we needed to understand how the facts of Israeli politicians like to call facts on the ground, how they are produced. How is planning produced? How is architecture being produced and mobilized as tactical tools within this conflict? So on the one hand, there was a process of mapping. On the other hand, a deep investigation of the history of its emergence. So I'll give you an example. Here you see a small square on the map. And that part is here in bigger form. This is the part of the city of Ramallah, the Palestinian effective administrative capital of the West Bank. Here in blue, you see the Israeli settlements. And starting in the 2000s, it became difficult for the Israeli government to authorize architects and builders to build new settlements ad hoc. Israel was simply bound by international guarantees it was giving to the Americans. And they had to resort to all sort of pirate kind of techniques in order to do that. And one of them I will tell you about now. Here you see a bend in a road. And bends in a road usually, or roads bend usually, where they have something to bend around. And what this road bended around was a hilltop. And hilltops are rather strategic instruments in controlling the territory. Here is the hilltop. You could see that it was inhabited, or at least used. If this image would be clearer, you could see terraces, olive terraces. So it was privately owned by a Palestinian family, and still settlers wanted to take hold of it. In order to do that, they resorted to a rather sophisticated method. They could not take the private Palestinian land, so they've asked a mobile phone company to put an antenna on this hilltop. Now, in order to get that antenna, they had to argue that not having an antenna is a security risk, that as they drive around this bend in the road, they lose reception on the mobile phone for 20 seconds. And on this time-space gap, they could be attacked without being able to call for help. So the government authorized an antenna. And indeed, maybe you could see it here, one was built. So now it's not only a topographical point and a bend in the road, but there is electricity that is connected to the antenna. So it's this antenna now, and the hilltop is charged with infrastructure. There's water because you need to mix the concrete and for it to harden. But antennas are also expensive bits of infrastructure. So the company, the mobile phone company, it was Orange, had to ask for a guard, for a 24-hour guard, to go and live by the antenna and protect it. And indeed, in this kind of container, prefabricated home, a guard could live, but there was water and electricity already there, so it became rather comfortable, and his family could move with him. And after a while, his friends came over, and a settlement was created. So you could see that the process of planning is not always a top-down government decision that is articulated through the sketchbook and then CAD programs of architects, but emerges out of different players: corporation, mobile phone production, settlers, independent group that wants to undertake it, etc. And indeed, this kind of colonization of small points that would later coalesce into a kind of suburban communities is very much one of the kind of starting points of many settlements. Here are what is called outposts. So, you know, you would say in the West Bank there are now about 150 official settlements and about 120 outposts. outposts are illegal, but the government does nothing to remove them unless they really have to, and, you know, very, very rarely. And as you see also in this one, it is built, obviously, around a mobile phone antenna. So if in previous millenniums, cities had to build around the myth, I don't know, of a wolf giving milk to two baby humans. Now the kind of right of establishing a new city is a mobile phone antenna. But indeed, a community could kind of coalesce and assemble finally around that point. But then, of course, there are the architects, those architects that at the time we were trying to bring to the ICC, those architects that we thought were violating human rights on the drawing board, in the way that they were designing, that they were laying out those communities, in the way that they were drawing lines on plans. And I would like to basically explain to you some of the principles of what would seem otherwise to be very benign, very normal kind of garden city type planning and its darker side. So, I mean, here you could see very clearly how a Jewish settlement built in ring fortress-like around the summit contrast with a kind of more informal fabric of Palestinian areas. The settlements, before they are built, what they design is very much the view from the hilltop. So you see, before, on that plan, before anything has been put on the area, it is the direction of vision that are dictated. That kind of overlooking of Palestinian areas here, that is simultaneously one of surveillance, but also, because they are real estate products, you need to sell homes there to people, they are also presented, that surveillance gaze is presented also as a kind of a resource, because you're looking at the biblical figures, you're looking at the kind of the primitive, at the kind of atemporal Palestinian fabric that is simultaneously pastoral and threatening, right? So there is a kind of paradox in this vision. And this is the way the form of the settlement kind of formalize this optical device, an optical device on a suburban scale with the homes looking outwards, perched on a hilltop as security points, and or here sprawling along the kind of the ridges of the desert, as in Ma'ale Edomim, one of the biggest settlements in the West Bank. And here you see that whatever might look as simply architectural design, every element here is a kind of an instrument of control. Every banal element here is an instrument of segregation, separation, and control. And the area finally end up looking like that. So that's a detail from a map that I've removed place names from, for you to be able to see the formal complexity that is generated by this neo-colonial project. You could see here in this map, you could see in brown the Palestinian built fabric, in lighter brown the area under Palestinian control, in dark blue the built Jewish settlements, and in lighter blue the area under their control. And you see in this formal complexity all the legal, political, strategic, military, economical forces becoming form. If it would be simple, or if Israel would have won that conflict offhand, this map would have been completely blue. But it's not. There is resistance. And there is a way in which Palestinian villages and community resist simply by staying, by what they call tzumut, by clinging on to the land in spite of the enormous force of that invasion and colonization. But also, the fragmentation of the terrain is so complex, it's so insane, it's so schizophrenic, that it's also almost impossible to weave together, because if you are a Palestinian, you cannot drive through the blue part of the map, and if you're an Israeli, you would feel completely insecure to enter and drive, and you, in fact, you're not allowed by law to drive through the beige part of that map. In fact, when I'm working, my studios and partners are in the Palestinian part of that, in the brown part of that map, I'm entering there illegally. I'm not allowed by my government to enter into the beige part. So those two, imagine how to weave infrastructure amongst and between this insanely complex pattern that is not even static, but is continuously morphing as new geopolitical and local forces translate and slow into form. Form is slowed down forces in that relation. In order to weave that area together, you need to resort to the third dimension. Here, an image of the wall here in white, cutting through the landscape, separating two sides of in kind of this insane schizophrenia of the terrain. And then in order to weave through, and that you see a Jewish road going over this landscape, bridging over Palestinian areas, right? So you have Israeli cars driving over columns, very high columns on a bridge, perched over Palestinian areas, and then going here into a tunnel underneath them. So the division is not only on the surface, but it is in three dimensions, something that I called the politics of verticality. Right, the terrain is divided. The kind of very intense separation and fragmentation of the terrain necessitate its weaving in three dimension, and the separation to be also in the above and the below. I mean, an international border. Think about it running in a thermodynamical joint between the column and a road. Right, the kind of the geopolitics becoming architectural details in this instance. And you see here those tunnels that are everywhere to be seen throughout the West Bank. And this politics of verticality that is also clearly manifested in the overlooking in the fact that the Israeli settlement here on the left directly overlooks the Palestinian community here in the bottom. So the vision out of the house is both a suburban kind of resource and a strategic one. But this is there also military gaze that is overlooking the terrain, and here overlooking the refugee camp of Balata, one of the densest part of the West Bank. And in fact, when we move now from Israeli Jewish architecture into Palestinian one, you would see also a shift in the kind of material practice of domination. If Israel's architecture of occupation in building settlements is building roads and bridges and walls and hilltop settlements, in its architecture of control of Palestinian built fabric, it's about the architecture of destruction. On the one hand, you build, on the other hand, you destroy, but both construction and destruction are designed elements and have that design dimension to them. And I will show you how that works on a micro level, on a very small scale. Because when soldiers, when Israeli commandos were asked to enter into this, one of the densest part of Palestinian fabric, they would apparently lose their advantage, because their advantage is exercised by going with massive fire, with tanks into it. But they needed to penetrate that area in a different way. And this is how they developed a quasi-architectural technique of walking through walls. And you could see... Moving between one house and the other by making holes in the walls and moving sometimes hundreds of meters long between without ever stepping through the street. So look, this is a map of that maneuver where you need to understand the city. The Israeli army needed to employ architects in order to tell them how to avoid walking in the streets, how to avoid using the existing circulation infrastructure of Palestinian areas and cutting through their own way, redesigning the city, so to say, by their movement. Moving through the city as if they were worms going through apples, again, in three dimension, moving between one house and the other by making holes in the walls, holes in the ceilings, going up and down, and in that way gaining control of which, and turning the house, the domestic space, into a site of conflict, right? You see how the movement of soldier through Palestinian homes turns the domesticity into a battlefield, right? I mean, we had testimonies by Palestinian civilians describing the experience of being in a house, watching TV, the whole family, while hearing knocks on a wall, not knowing what has happened. All of a sudden, a hole is made in one of the walls of their house, and some 20 soldiers walking in. The lady described them like giant insects because they had all these antennas and all sort of like equipment sort of poking out of their back. But they looked for nothing in this house. They simply said, apologized to the residents and broke another hole in the opposite wall and disappeared into it as they moved on through the city. But of course, design by destruction is also the destruction of refugee camps in a way that tanks could go through them. And we need to understand something that is called herbicide, the destruction of city, not simply in statistical terms, how many buildings were destroyed, but in design terms. What form did the military want to undertake by destroying here the refugee camp of Jenin in that particular star formation? Was that a way for tanks to move in? We know already from principles of 19th century town planning in Paris, in Barcelona, in other places, that the cutting of big boulevard through the dense urban fabric is a way of controlling urban revolt. It's a way of subduing the revolutionary potential, the resistance that exists in the city. So architecture also exists as a kind of design by destruction. And you have it sometimes comically. This is a place that is built by Israeli soldiers in order to train in urban warfare, some kind of Mickey Mouse-like houses that soldiers should imagine is a Palestinian-built fabric, simply drawn as if it's in a child game, but this is an environment in which they train. And then entire cities that are built by architects to simulate the Arab city. Here, a city built out of one element that is simply multiplied in different patterns, sometimes high-rise, sometimes a kind of like a low-density neighborhood, sometimes a kind of a shanty or a refugee camp. So an entire city, a ghost city, for training for Israeli and also, by the way, for American soldiers before they're coming through to the Middle East. And you see already how in this ghost town is the holes in the walls are already built into the architecture, right? Because soldiers would never walk through the door because, of course, in the door they could be expected. They will never look out of the window because this is where the enemy sniper would expect to see them poking their head out of. They would always redesign the house, reperforate it in order to use it strategically and tactically. So it's really with understanding that architecture and architectural thinking exist in colonial planning, of course. Colonial planning needs its architects. In its forms of destruction, of course, urban warfare needs its architects to do the military bidding to control urban areas, we needed to find another potential in architecture. We needed to insist that architecture could also allow us to tell stories in a different way than the traditional or the more traditional human rights methodology of interviewing victims, etc. Not instead of them, in a way that complement them, in a way that is tuned both to the human voice and to the material trace and bring them together. And at that moment, another attack has happened. So we, in between the Israeli attack of Gaza in 2008-2009, the one I started the lecture with, and the Israeli attack on Gaza in 2014, the most recent one that I'm sure you've heard of, where again, the same pattern has happened. 25% of the buildings in Gaza either destroyed or damaged. More than 2,000 people killed. We had already established by then the organization Forensic Architecture and started to think about how to tell the story of that attack as archaeologists, as the archaeologist of the present. And of course, when that war started, just like the previous one, the borders were closed to journalists. If you were not already there, you could not enter. And definitely for all human rights activists, they were not allowed. We were working together with Amnesty and Forensic Architecture. Access to Gaza was denied. We had people there, people working there in contact with us continuously. But the difference between 2009 and 2014 was massive, technologically and politically and juridically. Different things happened in those intervening 5 years. First of all, technically, technologically, smartphones became available in the Strip. People started filming what was happening around them. Sometimes they were filming them without and instead of running away. Sometimes they could save their lives, but they preferred to switch on the phone, look backwards, and document and upload and send it, upload it online as if those were simply messages in a bottle, as if wanting to say somebody would look at it, somebody would care, somebody at least would share in our pain. Somebody must know, people must know outside what it means to be under siege for 60 years and under attack and under bombardment, caught between siege line and sea in that way. Legally, Palestine, the war started in July. In a previous April, the Palestinian government ratified the Rome Statute, allowing the ICC to have jurisdiction over Gaza. And as we know, the ICC is very slow, very politicized. But that thing gave also hope to people that accountability is possible and led to the formation of various coalitions in between Palestinian NGOs. In there. So people gathered and the collection of evidence became something of a collective project. So that was the reality in which was very different. The kind of archaeology we had to do was not one of haptic nature, i.e. of tactile, touching, measuring the ruin like an archaeologist would do when they excavate historical site, but looking at the ruin as it is captured by the victims themselves, on their terms, not like expert going to site, but looking very carefully at what people were sending and sending to us or uploading online, because sending and filming that material in real time was extremely precarious. The Israeli open fire instruction was shoot to kill anyone aiming a camera at Israeli soldiers. right? So people risked their lives, and the one thing we could do was to honor it by looking very carefully at what they filmed. If somebody writes carefully, you need to read carefully, and that was the attempt at that time. So we collected over... Amnesty asked us to research one day in the conflict. It was the day, the most violent of the days of this conflict. It was August 1st, 2014, to tell a story of 24 hours within it as a kind of allegory to, or as holding the essence of so much else that was going on that time. And what we got was 7,000 clips and about 70,000 images that were given to us. And when you look at them like that, there's very little you can say. Well, you can say, I can see civilians escaping with white flags. I can see bombardments. I can see medical facilities being attacked. I can see people running away. I can see smoke plumes. I can see bomb fallings. But how do you connect those things? How do you actually build a story from all these floods of terabytes of information, of images that come at you at a time? Of course, what you need to do is to locate, first of all, locate and time each one of those clips. But the problem is that when material comes from social media, from Facebook accounts of people in Gaza, from the YouTube channels, from Twitter, from wherever other website they uploaded material to, the metadata, that is the information that about every file, when and where it was filmed, is lost. You don't have it. You know the day because people said that is August 1st in Rafah. So you know the day, but you don't know the time and you don't know the place. So what we had to start doing is a very slow and systematic locating and timing of each one of those images. And this is what I will show you quite slowly today. Of course, in locating, in timing an image, and I will show you later a clip, the easiest thing, although it's not very easy, to determine time is obviously shadow, right? We know sundials. And the city, in a sense, is a giant sundial. Every photograph has a shadow, and the shadow is unique to the time. So if you'd build a 3D model of the city, you could actually compute and calculate the shadows. But of course, the further away you are from the shadow, like in this image, the less precise the time indication could be. So you need to look for other analog time indicators in images. And after about 4 months of looking at images and trying to determine the time by looking at the shadow, we realized we were, in fact, looking at the wrong part, at the wrong half of the image. We were looking simply at the Earth, but the time information was in the sky, in the bomb cloud that were there. And looking at bomb clouds, and that day, August 1st in Gaza, was a very cloudy day, as you would see. There were thousands of bomb clouds. It's something that art historians did, or looking at clouds rather than bomb clouds, art historians did since the Renaissance, basically. Trying to study cloud forms, trying to determine the way of painting clouds and arranging them in paintings. And we were looking at the way they were studying that. Here in the image, you have John Ruskin, a very famous English art and architectural historian, and his diagrams of cloud perspectives, of determining location of clouds, the architecture of the sky. But looking at clouds, bomb clouds, was interesting in another way too. Because we had to start looking at the bomb cloud as architects, at the mushroom, at the form of the mushroom, as architecture, meaning it has a form, and that form can reveal a lot about the location, time, but also about what has been bombed. If you think scientifically about a bomb cloud, what it is a result of the low pressure generated at a bomb site that sucks in all debris from the pulverized building. When I say all debris, think about a house and what exists in a house being bombed. That debris is composed primarily of concrete, a little bit of plaster, some wood, some plastic, some cloth. There's a lot of clothes in this home. Some glass. Some of the things one has in the bathroom. Some of the chemicals, cleaning material. And also some of the body parts of the people that were lost, that died. All that get mixed together in this infernal column that rises up during several minutes until it reaches a level when it evens out with the atmosphere and open up outwards like an umbrella until it sort of rains the bits into the shadow of the mushroom. So what you're looking at when you're looking at the cloud is a building in gas form. You're looking at temporary architecture existing for 8 minutes, and you need to look at it carefully. So we started collecting all the bomb clouds, all images of bomb clouds, and we started to look for similar patterns. And then if we saw the same cloud in two images coming from different parts of the internet, we would know that they are at the same time. So we could place them in one part. And if we could model the architecture, we could actually start triangulating. We see, okay, that image is taken of this angle of the mushroom and this image of that angle. So we can start locating roughly where they were taken from. So here you can see a little bit of the process. So you see here a bomb falling in a civilian neighborhood. That bomb killed 16 people. And here is our archive of images. And we start looking for that bomb in other photographs. So we scan all the photographs and we see something that we suspect to be the same bomb in three different images. But we need to look at it carefully, and we need to find whether we can locate the same moment and then sync up those clips. So the syncing process is based on architectural and identification of minutiae within the form of the cloud. So we have here now three images that are synced up together. Now we need to find out where it is. So we're looking at the satellite image, and we start identifying elements on the ground that we can see in the image, a water tower and a football stadium. We draw a straight line between them, and we know that the photographer of this image is somewhere along this line. So we start putting numbers on those buildings and trying to establish the cone of vision. The projector is not perfect here, but you can see some of that, and if you'd like, you can go to our website to see it in more detail. So now more or less we have been able to establish that photograph was taken, of course, 4 months before, earlier, in this place, and then do it three times, triangulate the location of the cloud and find the precise moment where it landed, and confirm it by looking at before and after images, and in fact seeing that we could identify the location of that bomb. But you see here that we can see also another cloud in the satellite image. When the satellite passed over the battlefield, by chance, it caught a bomb just seconds after detonation. Okay, let's leave it for a second. Here is the way we demonstrate the shadow analysis. Here you see the two uprights with a shadow. This is where the camera is close to the shadow. You need to convert the image into an architectural model by correcting the lens distortion. So here now you turn the image into a 3D model, very simple and very, very basic architectural software. There's nothing sophisticated in it. You run a sun simulation, and you see that we are at 1053 simply by looking at the shadow. And now, so we know the time here. Now we see this cloud. So we need to start looking for that cloud within this, you know, all the images that were sent to us. Can we see exactly, can we sync it up with a satellite image? We know the satellite, the time that the satellite come out. So in this image, we see a sequence. We find somewhere a sequence of images of clouds. And we need to, and here on those we had the metadata, but as you see, the metadata is wrong. It says it's just before midnight, which is not correct because we see light. So we locate all those images of bomb clouds in a sequence, in a time sequence, and then start looking for each one of those. And here, trying to find whether that bomb that we see here in the satellite image is in fact the same bomb that we can see here from the surface by measuring its architecture, its dimension, its size, and here we are able, in fact, to sync it up. And now, the minute we synced it up, we know the time of the satellite image, so we can now have all those clouds we know the time of. So we have a kind of a converter, a translation of cloud form to digital time, that we can start building a timeline from it. So we are seeing here the timeline of the day. We are, the minute that we can match the cloud, we can place the time, and you would see how the architecture of the clouds, of the sky, enable us to put all those images in a sequence. And then, obviously, we were able to, or we turn our attention to the ground and start telling the stories that were encoded within the ground part of these images, such as that, a bombing next to a hospital. Now we had to place all the images within a model of the city. The model become the only way to weave through not the timeline, but the spatial relation between those places. So the model becomes something like an something we call the architectural image complex, a way of viewing all those images together. Here we are locating. Sorry, let me skip a little bit forward. A little bit less. Here you could see the bomb. We could actually identify one of the bombs fraction of a second before it hit, and the lawyers at Amnesty asked us to identify which bomb it is, who is the manufacturer. In one frame of 24 frames a second, you have the bomb, and we needed to measure it. So we placed the image within the model. We placed a grid behind it. And by simply measuring the size of the bomb and going through catalogs of manufacturers, we were able to determine that the bomb is of a particular type, catching it a second before landing, and that enabled the lawyers to bring in pressure also on manufacturer and supply chain issues. But you see here how the model itself becomes an optical device, becomes a way of navigating between clips, how each here handheld video being placed within the model allow you to understand the context, what happened before, what happened after, what happened next to it. The model is the only way to make sense between all those images together. And then also synced up with testimonies. Because the testimonies of civilians were also related to this and that bomb cloud. So the bomb cloud is kind of an element that connected the material ruin, the media, and the memory of witnesses, allowing to cut across all these material together. Where are we? Yeah, and go through the victims of that particular bomb. So working with technology and working architecturally, working conceptually with what is architecture, using art history as a guide to identify the architecture of the sky, is not necessarily a kind of an anti-humanist position that kind of seeks to replace the human voice, but to complement it, to build a story, to use architecture as an arena that somehow combines media and matter and memory, and all those things together are presented within those architectural models. And here is it, simply just to show you how our own diagram looked. This is not part of the report, but this is kind of what we had on our desktops, how we located each one of those clouds is finally a location. We could plot here all the pathways of each one of the survivors and the witnesses within it, the location of hospitals and other facilities, the artillery here in lighter kind of orange, etc. So it's about putting information together and being able to tell the story. Often, the work of forensic architecture tries to bypass restrictions, information restrictions. In Gaza, it was the restriction to enter. We could not enter, and therefore we worked with social media. Sometimes you don't even have images. There are no journalists in some places. There are no civilians with smartphones to record. There is no even internet connection to do that. Or you are having to research some of the most horrific places in the world, the torture prison, such as the torture prison of Saidnaya in Syria, operated by the Assad regime, by the government in Syria, the most notorious of prisons / concentration camps in Syria where political prisoners disappear into, severely tortured, starved to death, executed. There were few survivors, though, and they became refugees and arrived in Turkey and wanted to be able to understand where this place is, how is it organized from the inside, what is its architecture, understanding also that in a prison, architecture is also the instrument of torture. Architecture, the building itself, is not only the place where torture takes place, but architecture is the means by which pain is administered. And when you have absolutely no images, we were tasked again with Amnesty in building a model, in building the story of those survivors, we had to find a different conduit. We had to develop a new technique of doing that. And we understood the architectural dimension of memory. I mean, all of us know that There is some relation. It's different with each one of us. It's very complex. It's never linear. It's never clear. But there is a relationship between the architecture of a place and the memory that you have of it. Sometimes you walk through places and you start remembering things that happened there. Sometimes in order to memorize, we all know the memory palace, the technique of memorizing long speeches or other things by imagining a complex villa or palace and walking through it and picking up the memories that we place within rooms and attached to objects, etc. And we wanted to do a certain technique like that, the art of memory for the digital age. And our idea was to sit with those survivors and through a long process, model with them architecturally the building they were held in. And then we hope that through the process of modeling, we would do two things. One, we would end up with an architectural model based on the memory of the survivors. And two, the process of modeling would hopefully allow the detainees, the survivors, to recall those things that are most painful and that they were repressed in their memories. Because all of you who worked with survivors know a simple truth about human rights work and the victim, and that is that the most important, sometimes the most painful memories of survivors of atrocities are those hardest for them to access. That you cannot simply go to somebody who survived atrocity or trauma and ask them to recount to you what has taken place. That there are mechanisms that black out, sometimes distort, sometimes repeats those very elements that hurt us most. And when we worked with those detainees, all of a sudden we start getting a building that was very distorted. Corridors that at a certain point we realized to be 50 meter long became 250 meter long. Number of doors that we knew to be different multiplied. Voices, sound levels, all those things became different as they came across through memory. But working with five detainees, we were able to create a model that did two things. We're trying to both faithfully reproduce how this place is in reality, but kept all the errors in memory, all the distortions as resources in their own right. Because we know now in all juridical culture that a lapse of memory, a distorted memory of a survivor, is not something that should disqualify a testimony, but something that should be attuned to. Because in that distortion exists two things, both a representation, a real representation of the space, and a representation of the trauma through which the space is filtered to us, i.e., the distortion contained more information than a faithful memory. Right. So with that in mind, we went with the detainees and started producing a rendering of that place, Saidnaya, both inside and outside. And in fact, realized that one of the biggest problems for detainees is that they were led through that building blindfolded. In fact, they haven't seen it at all. What they have is a memory of how many steps they've taken, how many doors were opening and closing, what was the echo and reverberation of the space in different locations within it. And we worked with a sound and audio forensic guy, a member of our team, and PhD student of mine called Lawrence Abu Hamdan, who was also very well-known and very good audio sound artist, who worked with the detainees in creating soundscapes of and trying to identify through the audio memory the architecture of that place. So here I'll give you just a very brief. Here is Lawrence, and we're playing to the survivors various things. Here they're building models. They're describing something between their incapacity to see and also hear, and describing this dark space in which they were held in very degrading conditions. So here again, you see CAD software. You see very simple sound software that is repurposed not for design but for becoming a conduit to memory, right? Working on these technologies allowed us to get memories that were otherwise not delivered to the straightforward or, you know, amnesty interviews that were simply asking them what they remembered. We established together a doorway into memories. I'll give you an example of that situation. Here we were asking somebody. Okay, the sound doesn't work somehow. Oops. Okay. All right, let me describe to you the situation. Hania Jamal, an Arab-speaking architect working with us, was asking that detainee to simply, they were building the architecture of the door, and they were speaking about the hatch, and she asked, where was the hatch? Just very practical question. How big was it, and where was it placed? There is a loop here. Right, and all of a sudden, a memory sprang out of it. Because she asked him, how wide was it? And he said, it was as wide as my face. And then he remembered that it was as wide as his face because he was asked to push his face through the hatch, half his body or his body inside the cell, his head outside, and he was beaten, repeatedly kicked in the head to unconsciousness as he was with his head out, right? So sometimes this description of a simple architectural element allow this most horrific of recollection to take place, and also shows you how the architecture was itself the instrument of torture here, not simply the location. Here another example, when another one of the detainees was describing what we knew at that point to be a straight corridor. But he said, no, that was a circular space. I was beaten in it, and I could see, now we know this is how the corridor looked like. So the corridor, according to other witnesses. But he could swear to us, no, it was a spherical space. He opened his eyes when he was beaten and he saw that spherical space. And we asked him to model it and we model it slowly. I'm sorry, the sound doesn't work. But this is how he modeled it. So the straight corridor distorted and bent into a kind of a all-enveloping, space of total immersion. The experience, and he confirmed it, the experience of being in a space of total incarceration presented itself into the form of that space. May I have a few more minutes, or 5, 10? You want me to finish? I can go on forever, but you want 5 more minutes? Okay. Another situation was in when we were asked by the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights at the time, somebody that I think some of you might know well here, Ben Emerson, to look at drone strikes in Pakistan. Again, siege around Waziristan did not allow any cameras to come in and out. There were very few images, but one clip, 43 seconds long, was smuggled by being passed through 6 hands. So somebody passed it to somebody, passed it to somebody, passed it to somebody, and it arrived in Islamabad. And it was the first clip that showed the effect of drone strike. And it was broadcast by Rachel Maddow. And actually what it showed was a pile of ruin. You could tell something was ruined, but there was no much more commentary offered at that time. Now we thought a piece of footage that took six hands, that so many people had to risk their lives in order to smuggle beyond siege line, the siege line of the Pakistani military that is operating, in fact, supporting the American one, American drone strike there. We needed to look at it very carefully. And here, what you see is a kind of an interior study that we've made of this image. We started to see shrapnel on the wall. We've built a collage of all the different frames, and we started to mark every shrapnel on the wall that we could see within that room. And all of a sudden, we started studying those patterns. There was a hole in the ceiling from which the rocket came in. And we started noticing that within the pattern of fragments, there were two areas that had less fragments in them. If you see on the right, center right of this image, those areas were places where we believe the people were killed. We know four people were killed in that strike. Their bodies must have absorbed the shrapnel in it, and therefore the silhouette was etched, the silhouette was photographed on the wall behind them. That is to say, architecture here operates like it was a film exposed to the blast, like a film is exposed to light, right? Architecture is a media form. Pathology and architecture here combined, because we have a representation, we have a kind of a basic photograph of the human figure etched into the building. But we had to study it more carefully in order to locate the exact point where the bomb has taken place by numbering each one of those shrapnel on the wall. It's a very, very systematic, very slow work. We cannot apply it into each and every rendering and photograph of a ruin that we find. Each one, it's takes months and months to analyze. And effectively, we needed to, this is almost each one of those fragments is as big as my hand. We had to draw the exact form of chipping within the plaster on the walls, number it, and build a model. This is a model of the room. Whatever you see in black, an area that were not captured by the smartphone as it was kind of like moving frantically through the space. White is area that were recorded. Black are the shrapnel. And we had to place a light in the middle of the room in order to establish the precise points of impact. And with it, and now I need to cut this long story short, we were able to identify what missile it was and that the U.S. was using a new missile with a delay fuse and architectural munition. And we come back to architecture at the end of the lecture. A missile that can penetrate a building. You can program the delay fuse for it to go to the eighth floor, the third floor, always counted from the top, right? When you are a bomber, the first floor is the top one. So you go third floor down, you calculate how much time, and the blast is inside of it. Something that the American military armed forces presented as humanitarian technology. These are the lesser evil missiles. They kill less civilians. But by supposedly killing less civilians, they're much wider applied. Then they become the urban reality in so many of the cities of North Waziristan, Miranshine, Datakhel, Mirali, over them, to the extent that about 4,000 civilians were killed by drone attack at the time. So sometimes the lesser mean allowed it to be proliferate and for the greater evil to come incrementally through the repetition of lesser ones. So sometimes you are, as a forensic expert or as a forensic researcher, You're looking at minute things. You're looking at a single room. You're mapping out the very small patterns on the wall. You're establishing the precise point of impact and the shadow of bodies on the wall. But you need to understand that to make your practice political and significant, you need to be able to connect the micro and the macro. You need to understand that what you research on a small scale, one day in Gaza, one building in Syria, one room in Miran Shah, you're able to unlock a logic or something, you're able to understand something of the logic of the perpetration of violence on a much larger scale. And here, you cannot research each one of those strikes, but by researching very, very carefully one, you understand something of the logic that allows the lesser evil to proliferate violence rather than contain it. And I want to leave you with another image. And this is another beginning of a conversation. So it's the last image of the talk, but then one that leads now forensic architecture into a very long pathway of investigation. Having had data by working for the UN on all drone strikes that were identified since the early 2000s, we decided to locate them also on the meteorological maps. See whether there is a relation. What is in common with all those places in Pakistan, Afghanistan, in Syria, in Iraq, in Palestine, in Libya, in Somalia, in Yemen, in Mali, that are attacked by drones? And we found a rather astounding phenomena, that all those drone strikes operate along or are applied in very similar meteorological condition, at a place that meteorologically is defined as the beginning of the desert. All drone strikes take, or most drone strikes take place along the 200 millimeter rain per annum line. So, of course, we could say drone strikes are a way to stop desertification. No, I'm joking. But that there is something that combines human violence and climate and environmental change, that climatic conditions are able to aggravate conflict, and that we need now, as we move forward to seek accountability, to think about human rights. We need to think about it in relation to other things. We need to think about it again in relation to the Earth, to the planet, to its conditions, environmental condition and their change, to understand that human conflict and environmental conflict, environmental violence and human rights violations are somehow interlinked. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Weizmann, for that really fascinating talk. I think we've always known that buildings and spaces can tell stories, but you've really shown us how architecture can help us to unearth those stories with such precision. You've also shown us about the, reminded us about the overlap between security, policy, planning, the military, and business, and how space is produced and organized in a way to segregate, to dominate and control. And many of us here in this room today, I think, can relate to some of that and the ways in which post-war Sri Lanka space has been redesigned with those kinds of objectives. But I think what I appreciated about your talk the most was that you gave us some hope as well, that as difficult as these stories are, I think it's even more difficult to hide these stories. There are ways of unearthing them, and I think that's what your talk reminded us, that however hard the powers that be try to hide these stories, there are ways of unearthing these stories and remembering what happened and making sure that the stories are told. So thank you very much. Thank you. Mira.
Hi. Just a quick word of thanks. In order of priority, first I would like to thank Eyal's family, your wife and two kids, for violating the Holy of Holies and agreeing to not do your family holiday elsewhere, but to come here and do the talk. So thank you very much.
Sacrifice.
And also, thank you, Al. It was, I'm not going to summarize, I think Harini has captured some of it, but thank you for agreeing to come and give the talk, because really, as Harini said, it really is also a challenge that you throw to us, to also to look at things anew. So we will be, many of us in the room are really intrigued and will be in conversation with you, hopefully in the months also to come. And I'd just also like to thank all the staff at NTT who've had to work through all the logistics of this, in particular Mayanti, Saku, Priya, Rohan, Susikaran, and Dami. And my fellow board members, I should have introduced myself. I'm Mirak Rahim. I'm a board member of NTT. And I'd like to thank all the board members, in particular Shehara, who really used all her networks to try and make sure that Eyal had a really good trip, and also to Ambika and Jean, who worked through a lot of the, all the logistics to make sure all of this worked, including the last minute scramble to make sure the wires connected. So, last word of thanks also to the generosity of John Keels, who provided Eyal and his family a place to stay in Colombo, and the Ford Foundation, which also supported this initiative. There are refreshments outside, so please catch Eyal, talk to him, and thank you so much for coming, and hope to see you next year. Thanks.